Okay, welcome everybody. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is pleased to host the Southeast Coastal Climate Network's webinar series. On behalf of SACE and the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, I'd like to thank you all for attending today. It is your interest and support that make our work possible. My name is Erin Cameron, and I will be the acting facilitator for today's webinar, How Reforming Property Insurance Policies Can Better Protect People and the Environment. I'd like to take a moment to review your control panel on your screen. All of the lines will be muted for this presentation, and we ask that you please chat in your questions using the question option on your control panel. Your questions will be fielded in the order they are received and will be answered at the end of the webinar. All materials for today's presentation will also be available on the SACE website, cleanenergy.org. And I'd like to now turn the presentation over to Chris Carnevale, SACE Coastal Climate and Energy Coordinator.
Thanks, everyone, for attending the webinar today. My name is Chris Carnevale, and I'm the manager of the Southeast Coastal Climate Network. As you can see on the current slide, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is a coalition of individuals and organizations spanning the coastal Southeast who are working on coastal responses to climate change. We have members as far north as Maryland and as far west as Louisiana. The purpose of the network is to bring voices together, to trade information, and to synergize our efforts. The Southeast Coastal Climate Network is hosted under the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Our largest tool is our group site website, which is an online platform that enables members to send group emails, post discussion topics, or relevant news to discussion boards, and use a shared group calendar. If you're interested in joining the network and using these tools, please just visit the web address on the screen now, seccn.groupsite.com, and click Join This Group Now. For those of you on this webinar who are already members, I want to encourage you to use those tools to help get your message out. The purpose of the group is to encourage communication and collaboration, and you have a receptive group of people at your fingertips. So please don't be shy and use the web tools to your heart's content. Another great tool we have is our webinar series, of which today's webinar is a part. Today we're joined by Jay Lyles from the Florida Wildlife Federation, Josh Sachs from the National Wildlife Federation, and Jim Massey with the Reinsurance Association of America to talk about coastal property insurance reform and how it can help protect people and the environment. Jay Lyles is the policy consultant to Florida Wildlife Federation, the state affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation. There he directs the Federation's advocacy efforts on climate change, sea level rise, and the impacts of coastal development on insurance rates and availability. He is a member of the Southeastern Climate and Energy Network, where he has partnered with other organizations, including SACE, to advance climate and energy policy at the state, regional, and national levels. With that, I'll turn it over to Jay to introduce our other speakers for today's webinar.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity that you and Erin and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has provided to us to talk with your audience today. And I appreciate all of you who have decided to participate in this webinar this afternoon. I want to further introduce Josh Sachs, who you'll hear from in a few moments. Josh is the legislative director for the National Wildlife Federation, and he's housed at the National Advocacy Center in Washington, D.C. In this capacity, Josh serves as the strategic and coordinating outreach individual for their outreach to the members of Congress on key campaigns and priorities, including clean water, wetlands issues, energy policy, federal appropriations for wildlife conservation, and protection of public lands in Alaska and the Rocky Mountain West. Very recently, Josh played a key role in the passage of successfully passing the National Flood Insurance Program renewal with a number of key reforms to that policy. Prior to joining the National Wildlife Federation, Josh was the Federal Affairs Associate for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and a policy analyst at the Clean Air Council in Philadelphia. Josh has his BA from Ithaca College and is currently pursuing an MA in Applied Economics at Johns Hopkins University. We'll also be hearing from Jim Massey, who is a senior partner at Massey Law and represents the Reinsurance Association of America before the Florida legislature, and has worked for a number of years on property insurance reform efforts in both Tallahassee and Washington, D.C. He's a graduate of Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, has done graduate work in public administration at the George Washington University, and has a law degree from Florida State University. So clearly today we're going to be talking about the role of insurance and how it impacts climate change and is involved in that. And Aaron, I'd ask you to advance the slide now if you would. All right, well, that's working. I'm going to go ahead and start. So the overview of what we're going to talk about today is the current climate trends and the relationship that has to insurance. We'll be talking a little bit about the National Flood Insurance Program and some of those reforms, as well as other federal legislation. And then we'd like to bring it down to the Florida level and talk about Florida as a state-specific example, but something that we're seeing all across the coastal region of the country. Citizens Property Insurance is our government-backed entity, and the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund is the reinsurer to that and other insurance programs in Florida. Then we want to talk about some of the reform legislation that we're working on, both at the federal and the state level. And finally, we'll talk about the very interesting coalition that is building and has built around these issues. And Aaron, if you go to the next slide. So, much like the rest of coastal America, I'd like to give you kind of a lay of the land here in Florida. Florida is one of the most vulnerable areas in the world to the consequences of climate change, as we all well know, especially the effects of sea level rise and the possibility of strong hurricane activity and more frequent storms. In general, the elevations of the Barrier Islands are minimally above sea level, and much of Florida's Barrier Islands have been subject to extensive development of a high value, our ocean front that so many people come to Florida to visit. Much of Florida's coastal mainland is at low level and is subject to rising sea levels. And in fact, on any given storm day in South Florida during a high tide, you'll get fairly extensive flooding of a foot or a foot and a half on, say, South Beach of Miami. So how does insurance play a role in all of this, and how does it help us address climate change? And to begin that discussion, I would ask Aaron that you go to the next slide. So insurance provides you with a pricing signal, and the message is sent to the consumer in the form of a price charge for a commodity. And in coastal and other environmentally sensitive areas, the cost of insurance reflects the increased risk of building in harm's way. So in a perfect world, people would recognize the true cost associated with living and react accordingly, living on the coast and react accordingly. And we'd call that a pricing signal. In Florida, as in much of the coastal America, these pricing signals have gotten upside down. Through the manipulation of insurance markets, we've allowed risk to be socialized rather than held by the private insurance carrier and reflected in the premiums paid by owners of high-risk properties. And government-backed insurance acts as a perverse incentive to development by allowing reasonably priced property coverage on coastal structures and in low-lying, flood-prone areas like wetlands, many of which have environmental benefits if left undeveloped, and they can provide protection from storms. If you go to the next slide, Aaron. So in protecting their shareholders and producing a profit, the insurance companies have come to realize that they, unlike most of our policymakers, have to deal with sea level rise and begin to tackle climate change. Thus, the insurance industry, specifically reinsurers, who are the insurers to the insurance companies and spread risk over a global scale, have become a leader in calling for reform of insurance to better reflect risk, exposure, and prevent further socialization of the cost of its impacts. And I want to ask Josh to now pick it up from here and talk to you a little bit about the federal policy work he's engaged in, and then we'll return to Florida for specific issues before talking about the coalitions that we have built around these issues. So, Josh, I'd like for you to take over, if you would.
Sure. Hi, everybody, and good afternoon. Again, this is Josh. I'm at National Wildlife Federation here in D.C., and I presume, yep, I just got a note that you can all hear me, so let me proceed. You know, the first question I always get is, why flood insurance? Why would the National Wildlife Federation care? Why should someone who does climate work care about flood insurance? So, again, why flood insurance? Where is the relevance to climate or to the National Wildlife Federation? And that's what I'd like to talk to you about first, and then I'll get into some specifics of what we did with the flood insurance bill. So, flood insurance, because this picture you're looking at right now is something we really like at National Wildlife Federation. And first and foremost, because this is tremendous wildlife habitat. Aaron, show them the next slide, please. Yep, here's another great example of a properly managed floodplain, right? And not only is this great wildlife habitat, but this does a lot of other things that are really important for climate resiliency. When we have floodplains like this, water can settle and we can recharge groundwater aquifers. These areas act as buffers for pollution, so when nitrogen and phosphorus run off from farmland.
Oh, okay.
I think you need to mute your phone, Jay.
Yeah, there was some comments in there that was kind of setting it off, so we had a big, you know, blank margin for most of the pages.
Okay.
That's not my phone, unfortunately.
Sorry.
I'm not sure whose that is.
Okay. So anyway, we see these floodplains when nitrogen and phosphorus run to them. That exacerbates hypoxic zones or dead zones in waters, and we know climate change as it warms water temperature is going to exacerbate that, so keeping those nutrients out of water is really important. Let's show them one more slide. Here's another example. This is a levee here, but still we're giving a lot of room for the sea level to rise, which is a key part of climate adaptation, and we're leaving some element of natural habitat. Now, let's show them the next slide, please. Unfortunately, we've decided to do this instead. Show them one more. Next, yep. Here's another good example of how we've developed our shorelines, and let's show one more example if you could. This is Florida. Now, as we see sea level rise, as we see increased storm intensity and occurrence, certainly this area is not going to fare well. And part of the problem, part of the reason why we have this, is the National Flood Insurance Program. Can you show the next slide? This is a slide I like to show people. This is how we've managed our floodplain so far. It says building in a floodplain is like pitching a tent on a highway when there are no cars coming. And that's how we've developed. We've developed our coasts and our riverine areas as if to say, everything looks good right now. We'll be fine in the future. And we all know that's not the case. So can you show the next slide, please? Now we come to the National Flood Insurance Program. The National Flood Insurance Program, believe it or not, has been a major cause of a lot of that development I just showed you. And there's a reason why, as Jay sort of alluded to before. The National Flood Insurance Program charges a fraction of what the private insurance market would charge to insure risk. And what that means is we see tremendous development both in our riverine systems and in our coastal systems like Florida, and we lose all of this valuable habitat and we lose all this valuable open space that's really key for climate adaptation. And the main reason for that, as I said, is rates, but there are other reasons for that too. The National Flood Insurance Program, up till now, does not map its flood zones the way a private insurer would. Instead of looking at each property for gradations of risk, the NFIP just says, well, that area is going to do this and that area is going to do that. They go with sort of big lump chunks, which doesn't give us an accurate read. Also, the National Flood Insurance Program, when it's forecasting risk, has not fully taken into account climate change, sea level rise, more dramatic storms, and more occurring storms, more frequently occurring storms. So the National Flood Insurance Program was created by an act of Congress in the 60s, and it's authorized in five-year increments, and each time we have to reauthorize it, we have opportunities to make significant changes. National Wildlife Federation's got a long history. We've worked on, this is our third reauthorization of the National Flood Insurance Program. But this one, we really did a lot of great things that we think are going to help protect this habitat and help us with climate adaptation. So let me quickly run through three of the high points. The first is we increased the rates on a significant amount of properties. Not all the properties, but a lot of them. Secondary homes, vacation homes, businesses, homes that are sold and now the grandfather of that really low rate will disappear. We've increased rates on a lot of those. And as Jay talked about before, we think this will send a strong market signal that's going to keep these floodplains open, keep those floodplains that have not yet been developed from being developed, and we hope that's going to give us some room for climate adaptation. The second thing we were able to do in that bill is we've reinstated something called a Technical Mapping Advisory Council. I talked for a moment about how the mapping really wasn't good and it didn't take into account all of these key aspects of risk. Well, now we've created this council that will have representatives from an array of federal agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, the EPA, the Army Corps of Engineers, as well as state and local shareholders, or stakeholders, I should say, from groups like mine, from the insurance industry, and others. And together, they're charged with taking a look at how we map our flood zones and taking new things into account. And specifically, this bill says, the council shall consult with scientists and technical experts to be sure that flood insurance rates maps incorporate the best available climate science to assess flood risk. That's right, in this Congress, which is pretty divided, and as I'm sure you all know, somewhat hostile to climate change, we were able to pass a bill that specifically called on the federal government to address these impacts. That's a pretty big win, you know, for protecting people and property, but also for the climate movement. And finally, a piece that we worked really hard on is there are existing programs that FEMA runs to help people deal with risk. There's something called the Hazard Mitigation Grants Program, and there are several other grant programs that give people money to help them with resiliency. And one of the biggest uses of this money is to take communities, parts of communities or individual property owners who are in a floodplain, high-risk areas, and help them to relocate that community or that home to safer ground, to higher ground. And again, that opens up the floodplain. And it's in law, in the Stafford Act, it says once we move homes out of that floodplain, no federal dollars can go to rebuilding in that floodplain. So once we've moved people out, we have this natural open space in perpetuity that we can use for an array of things, including climate mitigation. Now, this bill passed the House of Representatives with 373 votes. It passed the Senate with 74 votes. For those of you who watch Congress regularly, in this day and age, those are unheard of numbers. This had tremendous support. And I'd like to talk to you about why for a minute, because I think that's really an important lesson here. In fact, I want to close by sharing two sort of lessons from this that I think are really relevant to the people on this call. So the first is the reason we were able to pass this bill with such tremendous support is we found an array of interests who all wanted to get to the same place but for different reasons. So insurers wanted to do this because it will make the market open up for the private interest to get into the market instead of just having the feds do it. Environmentalists wanted to do it for the reasons I explained. Free market groups, right-of-center groups, groups like the Heartland Institute who oppose climate change, groups like CEI, they want it for free market principles or for business interests. Taxpayers for Common Sense wanted this because they think it's going to reduce the $18 billion deficit to the federal treasury. And this was a tremendous lesson for me who does politics every day here in Washington, because when I would go in to see really conservative members of Congress, you know, Senator Dick Shelby from Alabama, for example, they would say, oh, you're with all those guys? Well, let's talk. Let's get something done. And together, this coalition, formerly called Smarter Safer, was able to bring both the left and the right together to pass this bill with such resounding numbers. You know, to have things like this climate piece sail through. And I think that's a real lesson for how we move forward on legislation more broadly, especially in this current political climate. And the second lesson I want to leave you all with as I wrap up here is what we did here was climate adaptation. There's no question. But we did it under the guise of flood insurance. And there are many other opportunities like this. There are opportunities to expand the Coastal Barrier Resources Act. There are opportunities to reduce agricultural subsidies that cause poor land use. They're sort of all different ways. They don't couch themselves as climate adaptation per se, and we don't call them that when we talk to Capitol Hill, but they are. And I think that's a really important thing for everyone to remember here is there are lots of ways to skin a cat. Sometimes it's best to do it under different guise, but this, what I think, was an effective way to move forward in that vein, and I hope it can be an example for many other avenues or pursuits as we move forward and work on climate adaptation. So with that, I'm going to pass it off back to Jay, and I'm happy to take questions when we wrap.
Thank you, Josh. And I just want to say we greatly appreciate the work you and the Smarter Safer Coalition did in working on this. And I think you pointed out something that we'll get into a little bit later here about the power of these coalitions that are forming around these issues. So, Aaron, if you would advance to the next slide. So you've now heard about the National Flood Insurance Program and its relationship to state programs like Citizens Property Insurance Corporation and the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. I'm going to do a rather long intro of Jim Massey, but what you have here, these are government-backed insurance programs that socialize the risk and incentivize building in the wrong places. These government funds concentrate the risk, and private insurance and reinsurance spreads risk globally, and that's the difference and the very important difference in why these entities are so interested in this work. Through the bond indebtedness, however, a state catastrophe fund concentrates risk in one jurisdiction and shifts the financial burden to the to those people who pay taxes, and quite often to people who have no relationship to the to living on the beach. They may visit, but they don't own property there. Essentially, low or no risk policyholders and taxpayers insure high risk government funds. So government catastrophe funds do not reduce the vulnerability of people to natural catastrophes. They're not a proactive disaster planning approach. Rather, they are a cost shifting mechanism which encourages continued development in high risk coastal and earthquake areas and shift the cost of disaster losses to taxpayers and others who may be at less risk and equally less willing to pay the subsidy. The CAT Fund, as I said, acts as a reinsurer to Citizens and other Florida-based insurers. And like Citizens, the CAT Fund has the ability to assess all Floridians to pay for bonds it issues and to pay its claims. The CAT Fund was intended to supplement, not replace, private insurance. In recent years, it's grown unduly large, leaving Florida's insurance consumers subject to potentially massive hurricane taxes or assessments. Assuming the CAT Fund could even sell the required billions of dollars of bonds in an increasingly fickle municipal bond market. Likewise, Citizens has grown to dominate the Florida market. And if you shift to the next slide. Thank you. Citizens is the largest property insurer in Florida, holding about 25% or one out of every four policies in Florida. That's 1.4 million policies and growing at a rate of about 1,000 policies a day. As of its last filing, Citizens' total exposure was about $500 billion or more. Citizens Insurance Company is subsidizing building in the most environmentally sensitive areas of Florida. Other states have a similar program, but they set the prices high enough that consumers rely on the private market. However, that's not the case in Florida, because in 2007, the rates for Citizens was frozen at the 2006 levels and undercut our private market. I think that that's going to give my friend Jim Massey an opportunity to kind of tell you what the impact of all of that has been on Florida. So, Jim, if you'd take it from there, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, Jay. Obviously, with Isaac out there focusing on the Gulf and focusing on Florida during this next week, this is a very timely issue. So far, I did partake in a telephone conversation this morning with some reinsurers, and while it's very early to forecast anything, thinking at this point is that Tropical Storm Isaac probably will become a Category 1 hurricane, so it won't be a major hurricane. Probably will stay off in the Gulf and will be more of a flood risk than it will be a wind risk. And we'll just have to see through next Tuesday and Wednesday whether or not that holds true. Another reason this conference is very timely is that the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Andrew is tomorrow. Hurricane Andrew was a paradigm-shifting event for insurance companies. It was a wake-up call for everybody, insurance companies included. No one thought that a hurricane could do that much damage. Not insurers, meteorologists, state officials, no one contemplated that. Florida's the peak catastrophe zone in the world when you consider the number of hurricanes that it's exposed to and the property value that's within Florida. With Hurricane Andrew, all of the profits of insurance companies over the previous 20 years were wiped away in a few hours. 12 companies went bankrupt. State Farm probably was technically bankrupt, but the mother company, the parent company, left its Florida subsidiary $900 million to continue. We don't know if that would happen again. You found after Hurricane Andrew that because Allstate and State Farm and other major companies such as Nationwide looked at their exposure in Florida and saw that their whole company, their Nationwide company, was at risk, they severely cut back their exposure in Florida, and that has produced a number of smaller sort of homegrown insurance companies, what we call Florida domestic insurance companies, that are beginning to pick up the tab. And also, obviously, it's spawned two state entities, Citizens Property Insurance Corporation and the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. Citizens used to be the insurer of last resort, the insurer that if a homeowner could not get insurance anywhere else, at least they'd be able to get insurance in Citizens. But unfortunately, when you have a state-owned entity, politicians begin to see the advantages of doing favors, what they consider to be favors for their constituents, and having low premiums, same problem that the federal flood insurance program had. So now for many people in Florida, Citizens is the insurer of first resort because their rate is about 33% below where actuaries say that it needs to be. Most of the Citizens policyholders are in Southeast Florida near the water. Up until a year or so ago, Citizens was insuring $3 million homes. Now they're down to $1 million homes. But you would find that Citizens still is insuring second and third homes, beach houses, all sorts of homes that that they probably should not be insured. The way the state comes up with low premiums is that they have a way of backloading the costs over a time period. In this case, it's up to 30 years. They can sell bonds after a hurricane has hit, and you spread that over the subsequent 30-year period, and so you don't have to pay for it up front in your premium as you would like we all do for our automobile insurance. Another way for the state to delay the cost is to have non-citizens policyholders subsidize the citizens policyholders. And what Florida has done is not make just the citizens policyholders pay the cost of the bonds that would be issued. That would certainly be fair enough. But what they've done, about 70% of the cost is going to be paid by businesses, automobile policyholders, charities, nonprofits, even local governments and school boards that purchase private insurance are going to pay a surcharge in order to subsidize citizens. A report came out just a couple of weeks ago, which was very interesting to me because it indicated that really only two counties, Miami-Dade and Hernando County, have a majority of citizens' policyholders. So in Florida, you've got the other 65 counties basically subsidizing the citizens' policyholders. The Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, which is state reinsurance to insurance companies, reinsurance basically is insurance for insurance companies. The cardinal principle of insurance is to spread the risk, and normally what happens in most states, insurance companies will insure your home. They purchase reinsurance. They purchase insurance themselves to kind of spread the risk around the world, and then reinsurers themselves will purchase reinsurance from other reinsurers to continue spreading that risk. Both citizens and the CAT Fund, as Jay indicated, concentrate the risk in Florida. Citizens did buy some reinsurance this year, not nearly enough, but they do want to buy more, so I think we're beginning to indicate that they're beginning to understand that they're going to have to start spreading the risk around the world rather than concentrating it in Florida. The CAT Fund also charges a very low premium, and they spread the cost out over a period of time up to 30 years. And they also have people who do not benefit from the CAT Fund who actually wind up paying the cost. So, of course, their premium can be lowered. Both citizens, this cost, this assessment that folks are paying, and those of us in Florida were all paying for the storms of 2004 and 2005 still, it's a hidden tax. It's not called a tax. It's called an assessment, but it's basically a tax. The Supreme Court has said that it's a tax. Why do you all care, or why should you care? I think you should care because you recognize that the state of Florida is subsidizing the cost of homeowners who live on the coast, and because of that subsidy, the real cost of living on the coast is not reflected in the cost to the people who are living there. Up until this year, Citizens itself was selling builders risk bonds, developers who could get insurance in the private market, but because it was more expensive, they would buy it from Citizens. They would be subsidized, basically, by everybody else in the state of Florida. That particular abuse has stopped with some reform, but we're still subsidizing people who really do have access to the private market, could pay the market rate. They've got these million-dollar homes. They've got two or three homes in some cases. So I think really what we're trying to say here is that the state itself has a policy of subsidizing people to live on the coast, and that's got a number of unintended consequences, many of which are reflect your concerns. That's it, Jay.
Thank you, Jim. So I know we're coming up on the half hour, if not just a little past it, and I want to leave time for questions. So, Aaron, I'm going to ask you to advance to the next slide, and we'll move along pretty quickly here to get to what's being done about this. So briefly, again, I think we've hit that point pretty well that pricing signals are upside down in Florida, and we're giving people a signal that it's right to build on a beach and build in a low flooding area, and that's exactly the wrong signal. So if you'd move to the next slide. So these coalitions are supporting what we believe is a market-driven, non-regulatory process by which we can limit coastal development in places where we shouldn't be building. We realize, those of us on this call, that these low-lying coastal areas provide both an economic and a wildlife and conservation benefit, but they're also our first protection against floods and wind due to major storms. And if you'd move to the next slide, Aaron. So we have produced some language, and this is just one part of many reforms that we're proposing to Citizens Insurance and the CAT Fund here in Florida. As Jim said, we're trying to reduce these entities back to the insurer of last resort. But certainly it makes perfect sense that we not continue to dig the hole deeper by insuring new construction on the seaward of the Coastal Construction Control Line or in Coastal Barrier Resources Act lands, of which there's over 600,000 acres in Florida, much of which is under pressure to be developed, and our members of Congress on a regular basis introduce legislation to remove areas from the Coastal Barrier Resources Act. And that's something that we're working diligently to stop from occurring. And if you go to the next slide. So I want to ask you, Aaron, just to hit your button a couple times here, and you'll get a better sense of the groups that we're dealing with. Yes, I think we're there now. So we built a very effective and diverse coalition around this, and I'll open the lines to both Josh and to Jim to talk about this in further detail, but I just wanted to talk about the fact that we have Smarter Safer, as Josh referred to earlier, smartersafer.org. Again, a very broad-based coalition, and if you'll go to the next slide on that. And one that has, because of its diversity, as Josh alluded to, it's really grabbed the ear of our policymakers because they see people coming from both the left, right, and center who have an interest in seeing that we don't continue to just depend on the public to pay for, in effect, the insurance of people who are wealthy enough to live on the beach. In Florida, we're building a Smarter, Safer Florida coalition. It is an informal coalition, and it may very well remain an informal coalition as we begin to express what our outcomes and objectives are. And we'll be happy to share with those of you who live in Florida the ability to join this coalition, to look at the principles that we've outlined here of reducing Citizens Insurance to an insurer of last resort, and to make sure that we're not allowing development in the wrong places. Currently, among its membership in Florida, we have the Florida Wildlife Federation, 1,000 Friends of Florida, the Nature Conservancy, Audubon Florida, the Sea Turtle Conservancy, and Sierra Club, among many others. And our business partners include Associated Industries of Florida, the Heartland Institute, and the Florida Chamber. And at this point, I would say that the real value of this coalition has been standing at a press conference, and we've had United Way there and the Tea Party of Florida at a press conference. And when you do that, when you have that kind of diversity, you see the press turnout, and as Josh said, it opens doors to policymakers who previously might have looked at this as more of a climate change issue as opposed to a dollars and cents, role of government kind of issue. And I would add that it has given us an opportunity to talk to other interest groups, other advocacy organizations like Associated Industries, and get to know each other a little better. And as opposed to showing up at a committee meeting and being on the diametrically opposite side of an issue and never having the opportunity to talk to one another, we instead have found that we have common ground on this, and we may have common ground on other issues. And so that dialogue has been very valuable to us and is paying dividends. Jim, Josh, do you all want to add anything to what I've just stated?
No, I would just indicate again what you and Josh said about getting diverse groups together and working together on a particular issue. Everybody's there, and they might have different reasons for being there, but on that particular issue, they come together, and it's impressive to legislators, the policymakers, when you can go in with two or three people who normally aren't together on any issue, but you can go in there and say, this is a matter of concern to all of us, and we think we have a solution for this particular problem.
Josh, anything further to add?
Nope.
All right. Well, Aaron, I think we can move to the next slide. And again, we want to thank everyone for the opportunity to address you on this issue. You have a way of communicating with us if you'd like to talk with me about Smarter, Safer Florida, or Josh Sachs about the smartersafer.org at the national level, or with Jim. You've got our email addresses, and we'd be happy to communicate with you about what we're doing here in Florida and at the national level. Aaron, do you want to open it up for questions now?
I do. Thank you so much. We have quite a few questions, so I'll just get started here, and then you guys can handle the questions, whoever would like to answer them. Let's see. One of the questions is, can you talk more about how you facilitate people moving out of flood zones? Once they are out, does the perpetual easement apply to individual parcels or larger zones?
Sure. So this is Josh. I raised that, so I'll answer that. I guess first and foremost, it should be clear that this program only happens with both the consent of FEMA and the property owners. And FEMA usually will come in and decide sort of at what scale they're going to do the project first and then talk to those property owners. And the perpetual easement is by parcel but will reflect the size of whatever scope of community or proper or structures are moved. I think that answers that.
Yeah. And I would just add here in Florida that quite often the answer is that a county or local government decides to buy that land from the owner and try to get them out of there, and that's probably not the most effective means of resolving this, but it's something that we're going to have to be looking at very closely as we go forward and we see more and more of Florida subject to flooding on a regular basis and making areas unlivable.
I should add one thing, which is we see this typically a lot more with our riverine system than we do with coastal beachfront type development. It's much more likely that they're going to move, you know, homes in South Dakota or in Montana, you know, on rivers like that than it is that you'll see them move a beachfront property, mostly because of cost and because of willingness of homeowners.
Great. Thanks,
sure.
Guys. Another question we have. In the legislation that Josh spoke about, what is the mechanism for incorporating climate science into the insurance programs? Is there a science panel to do that?
So as I said before, there's that Technical Mapping Advisory Council, or panel, I guess, and it's called TMAP is what we refer to it as, and that will have representatives from an array of federal agencies, some of which are charged with taking these things into account, like NOAA. And then as I read you that little blurb, that panel is charged with talking with and getting advice, guidance, et cetera, from scientists and other professionals on what the impacts of climate will be and how to best map them.
Great. Thanks, Josh.
Yep.
Another question. Do insurance companies integrate climate predictions such as sea level rise and increased hurricane intensity for planning purposes? How does it integrate this science?
This is Jim. Thanks, that. I think we're seeing probably over the past 5 or 10 years, reinsurance companies are certainly doing that. You see Swiss Re and Munich Re on the international level. They're very concerned with climate change. They recognize climate change. And they are doing white papers and doing studies and trying to incorporate it. It's a business decision on their part. Homeowners insurers, the regular companies that sell homeowners insurance to us, they may not be doing that quite yet, particularly here in Florida where you have the small domestic companies, but you probably have State Farm and Allstate and Nationwide, the larger national carriers. They're probably beginning to look at that as well.
Go ahead, Josh.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, most of these companies, their modeling is proprietary, so we don't get to see everything, and they don't want to share everything. But even if they're not saying the words climate change, if they're taking into account more extreme weather intensity, storm frequency, things like that, they are dealing with climate in some way, even if they don't necessarily go out and say it. And the last thing I would say is there's a group called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. I think their website is ceres.org. They're based in Massachusetts, and they are a nonprofit that does tremendous work with the insurance sector and others regarding climate. And you can check out their website. They have a lot of studies and research about this specific topic.
And this is Jay. I would only add that one of the reinsurers we work closely with, Renaissance Reinsurance, has set up an entity called Weather Predict, which does much of the research on this, can scale out the likelihood of a 100-year storm, a 300-year storm, a 500-year storm. And not only do they look at the impact of the storms, but they're looking at ways in which we can mitigate for storm damage. They've been a major contributor to the wall of wind in South Carolina, and I would encourage those of you listening in to either go to the website Weather Predict or just type in wall of wind, and you will see some of the research they're doing about new building techniques that would help people who are living in the way of in harm's way deal with it better, reduce their losses, and come out safer and happier in the long run in dealing with what, you know, we all know will be more frequent, more severe storms.
Great. Thank you so much. We have one more question, and it might be related to a question that you answered already, so I'm going to ask it anyway. How do we talk about retreating from the coast, simultaneously preserving an upland wildlife corridor in Florida, and not get involved with the sticky issue of human population?
Whoever asked the question, if you've got the answer, I'm all ears. That's going to be a tricky drive. That's going to be hard to accomplish, and it's going to be something we'll all be debating on the policy level and otherwise for years to come. It is obvious we'll not be able to have people living full-time in places like the Keys and places like West Palm Beach and Miami Beach, and those places will reduce their populations over the decades to come, and where those people move is going to be a question we'll all have to address.
I think that's right. I would simply add, you know, with respect to upland wildlife corridors, you know, the notion that open space and wildlife habitat areas and human development are incompatible, I disagree with, you know, and talked for a little bit about the various ecosystem services we get from these open spaces that really do have an impact on, you know, your wastewater treatment plant in your town and the rates you pay and, you know, how we deal with impervious surface and all these things. So I think that, you know, there's no easy answer, but certainly there is an equilibrium that we can find. You know, it's a moving target, but I think that there aren't absolutes in this regard.
Sure. Sure, and there's a subtext to this. There people who have been watching climate change and understand sea level rise and its impacts on Florida are also quite concerned that the millions and millions of dollars that we Floridians have put into Florida forever and creating public lands in Florida, that's in jeopardy. And certainly we've got to be diligent to make sure that we don't lose public lands to new housing developments simply because people see that as the easiest way to address climate change. that would be a shame and something we ought not to stand for.
Well, thank you so much, guys. Those are all of our questions for today. And thank you. Thank you for all of this information. I want to thank everyone for attending today's Southeast Coastal Climate Network webinar. SACE is very excited to take part in this webinar series. We'd like to thank all of our members on this call as well and encourage those of you who are not members to please join us today. For more information, please check out our website, cleanenergy.org. I encourage you to also view our blog or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And again, today's presentation will be available on our webinar archive page of our website. So thanks, guys.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you, Chris.
Thank you all. Great presentation.
Have a good day, everybody.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.